So this morning I'm going to give another talk on trusting heart mind. This is my fifth talk on it, and I'm only about 20% through, so I guess it'll be a long journey. Live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in the inner feeling of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. When you try to stop activity to achieve passivity, your effort will fills you with activity. As long as you remain in one or the other, you will never know oneness. And that should be in your program. Okay, come on in. Come on in and have a seat. So starting with living neither in the entanglement of outer things. Entanglement of outer things. Well, most of us pretty much know about that entanglement of outer things. And it takes so many different forms. So many different forms. And our culture, which is has such a materialistic focus, and other cultures in the world are beginning to pick that up. So it's almost like we're moving into world. This global capitalism means world materialism. That's what we're going for now. It seems to be as a human species. So that's what's going on. And the more we and that's not bad. It's just that the more we get entangled in trying to figure out how we can get more of whatever, the more distressed we become. It's just very simple. Very simple. I've talked before about studies on happiness. Happiness has no relationship to material wealth as long as you have enough to eat. And so, but we don't know that. We don't know that. At my other job right now, everybody is trying to figure out whether to give the staff 1.5% or 2% or 3% or 3.5% or 4% annual increases. And people are wondering, who's going to get what? Will I only get 1.5 and will she get 2? Well, that we get entangled. My second example for this morning is sex. Why not sex? So yesterday I Googled porn. I just P-O-R-N. You know how many hits I got? You know how many sites there are? There are 192 million. 192 million. I googled exercise. There weren't that many. But porn, 192 million. Is that bad or good? I'm not saying it's bad or good, but it is entanglement, you guys. It is entanglement, big time. Big time. And sex gets us out of ourselves. Porn gets us out of ourselves for a few moments, or maybe for more than a few moments, I suppose, if you really become an addict. And my friends have been telling me, my friends who are therapists, that there are more sex addict groups than ever in the United States. That they've doubled or tripled in size. Because why? Because of 192 million. Or, well, I don't know what the cause and effect is, but it's a simple addiction. It's addiction that you don't get hung over by. Doesn't leave you with any chemical residue. But it's certainly the entanglement in outer things, isn't it? So, our hero here, Sung-san, our Zen hero, says, live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in the inner feeling of emptiness. So the inner feeling of emptiness, I think of that in two levels. I think of the inner feeling of emptiness, which is when we just sort of give up. When we just give up. Years and years ago, I learned Salvador Minuchin way of looking at things. Salvador Minuchin way of looking at things is that there's a pattern that we learn in our families and in our lives, a pattern that moves between enmeshment and disengagement. And the more enmeshed we become, the more entangled we become, the more likely we are to want to disengage, to cut off. And those are mirror images of each other, enmeshment and disengagement. So years ago, when I was doing a little work as a couples therapist, years ago, before we were counting every minute that a therapist had to spend their time, in those days, you got to have two therapists with a couple. Can you remember those days? And now, you know, you can barely have one therapist because of billable hours and HMOs. So we had two therapists with a couple. And I wasn't particularly good at this. I never really got very good at it, but I liked it anyway. So anyway, it was the woman's issue was, or the guy's issue was, that the woman in this relationship, in this marriage, cut off. She disengaged. She wasn't there. When he brought up stuff, she just got quiet. I remember her saying that, well, she'd had a father just like that. I mean, this is typical therapy deal, right? A father who just like that, who was like him, who was bossy like he is, and erratic like he is, like her spouse is, and so she just disengaged. And my partner therapist, who just was a little smarter than I, said, but he's your partner. He's not your father. And you know, from the Zen point of view, we're all partners. We're all partners. There is no one in this room who's not our partner. There's no one in this city who's not our partner. And we disengage because we fear entanglement. We fear we'll get lost. We fear we'll get overwhelmed. So we disengage. And that's not bad. It's just that we suffer. And then we have depression, which is kind of the ultimate disengagement, Clinical depression, situational depression, depression due to grieving, all kinds of depression. And everybody's depressed these days. Nobody was depressed 30 years ago. Everybody's depressed these days. How many of you? I won't ask you to raise your hand. Because it's now it's normative to be depressed. Now, before it was shameful. Now it's normative. Oh yeah, a lot. Well, not quite normative, but it's almost becoming normative. It's almost becoming a badge of something or other. It's interesting how our culture has changed, isn't it? So depression. And for depression, what's the research say? It says medication can be important, but what else can be important? What's equally important? Engagement. Not disengagement, not enmeshment, but engagement. That means you don't feel like doing stuff, you do stuff. You don't feel like giving yourself to this activity, you give yourself to this activity. Just as good as medication. All the research says that. Zen practice, right? If there was anything that's like Zen practice, engaging, not disengaging, not getting all entangled. Then we have the higher feeling of emptiness, which is, I think, what Song was talking about, because I don't think he knew anything about. Well, I don't know. Maybe he did. I think he was talking about the higher feeling. The higher feeling, which is what we call enlightenment in Zen and Buddhism. An enlightenment experience where you let go of everything. And there's a great freedom from worries and concerns. And you see that stuff's just made up. That you've just been making that up for 82 years or 82 months or 82 minutes or 82 seconds. So that wonderful emptiness, that wonderful openness, that wonderful spaciousness. But he says, live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in the inner feeling of emptiness. So if you sit. So a lot of you are signed up to sit for our week sesshin, 7 days, our retreat coming up in December. A few of you are signed up for our one-day one, but many more of you for our seven-day one. That's interesting. I don't know what to make of that, but I don't have to make anything of it. All I do is show up. Anyway, and especially in a retreat, especially in a long retreat, there's a chance of having this kind of experience because you're just really focusing. But then what? After you have it, you want more. You want more. So you're gonna do 32 days instead of 7 days. Instead of 1 day, you're gonna do 7 days. And you're gonna do 7 days 3 times in a row. And you're gonna honor your commitment regardless because you want more. You want more. So where's your emptiness then? Where's your spaciousness then? Where's your engagement then? Your engagement then is what you're gonna get back. What you're gonna get. So in a way, I mean, I don't want to demean the enlightenment experience. How could I demean that? But in a way, it's not too different from the 192 million hits. I mean, you have the memory. The memory was great release. You want to do it again. You want to do it again. So, interesting, huh? So he says, live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in the inner feelings of emptiness. So supposedly when Buddha attained enlightenment, Mara, some of you don't know who Mara is. So Mara is the Buddhist devil, right? He's the Buddhist bad guy who tempts Buddha before he has an enlightenment experience, tries to get him entangled in sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but Buddha refuses. Right? And then Buddha has his enlightenment, has his awakening to his partnership with all of life, so that there's no separate Buddha anymore. There's just partnership. Just partnership. So then, does Mara go away? No, Mara doesn't go away. Mara hangs around for the rest of Buddha's life. Do you know that part? There ain't no enlightened retirement. There ain't no enlightened retirement. Sorry, Tim. I don't know why I even started this if there was no enlightenment retirement. Why did I get involved when I was 21 years old if at 67 years old there's still no enlightenment retirement? Give me a break. Right? There isn't any. There isn't any. Enlightenment retirement is disengagement. It's death. It's not alive. It's not partnering. So, a number of you heard me talk before about when I went to my root teacher, Suzuki Roshi, after I had an enlightenment experience. First, I had this enlightenment experience, and then I went home to see my mother, which is not a good idea after an enlightenment experience. Never a good idea, enlightenment or no enlightenment. But anyway, I went home to see my mother. And all of a sudden, I got entangled in everything. And so I came back to the Tassajara, and back to practice period, and I said to Suzuki Roshi, well, you even said I'd attained so-called enlightenment. He used the term so-called. You even said I'd attained it, but I said, I'm more sensitive to things than I used to be. And he said, oh yes. These days, when I make a mistake, I say, oh, that's awful. Oh, that's awful. So, Julian of Norwich, the mystic, if there be anywhere on earth a lover of God who is always kept safe, I know nothing of it. For it was not shown to me, but this was shown to me, that in falling and rising again, we are always kept in that same precious love. In falling and rising again, we are always kept in that same precious love. Engagement. When we really engage, love just blossoms, and we don't think about it. It just blossoms. because it's a real partnership. It's not trying to figure out who's going to be a good partner. It's just partnership. And whatever success we have is wonderful. We should joy and appreciate any successes we have. But there's always a shadow. There's always a shadow. And we actually, I think, learn more by falling than rising. We learn from rising, but maybe more from falling. Maybe more about just letting go. About returning to the humus, returning to the ground without even knowing what the ground is. Here's a Milarepa story that I haven't read for a few years. Long after his enlightenment, Milarepa went to collect firewood outside the cave where he had been blissfully practicing. When he returned, he found in the cave seven metal demons with enormous bodies and eyes the size of cups. Some were grinding barley and making fire. Others were performing magical tricks. As soon as Mila saw them, he became frightened. He meditated on the Buddha, uttered a subjugating mantra, but was unable to pacify them. He thought, these might be the local deities of this place. Although I have been here for months and years, I have not praised them or given them any torma. So he sang a song of praise. You non-human demons assembled here are obstacles. Drink this nectar of friendliness and compassion and be gone. The first three demons who were performing magic went away. Realizing that the remaining demons were magical obstacles, he sang this song of confidence. It is wonderful that you demons came today. You must come again tomorrow. From time to time, we should hang out together. We should partner. With this, three more demons vanished like a rainbow. The remaining demon performed an imposing dance, and Mila thought, this one is vicious and powerful. So he sang another song, the pinnacle of realization. A demon like you does not intimidate me. If a demon like you could intimidate me, the arising of the mind of compassion would be of little meaning. Demon, if you were to stay longer, that would be fine with me. If you have friends, bring them along. We will talk out our differences. Lord Vajradhara Buddha, grant your blessings so this lowly one may have complete compassion. Then, with friendliness and compassion, without concern for his body, Milarepa placed himself in the mouth of the demon, but the demon couldn't eat him, and so the demon vanished. Buddhist fairy tale, right? Buddhist fairy tale. So, next line. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. I've been talking during this series about the only king that the Taoist sages valued and they thought was wise. Who is that king?
Chaos.
King Chaos. Only King Chaos. Because only King Chaos lives comfortably in the Tao, in the way, in the engagement, in the partnership that is always going on. Only King Chaos has gone into the areas of most fear, most discomfort, most resistance. So, I saw an article in the St. Paul paper on Friday. And its title is, A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy One, Study Finds. Oh, smart guys. Here's the study, you guys. In a report in this week's issue of the Journal of Science, the researchers analyzed data from 2,250 volunteers in the United States to find out how happy they were, what they were doing, and whether they were thinking about their current activity or something else. and whether that something else was pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, or neutral. They could choose from 22 activities such as walking, eating, shopping, watching TV, and having sex. The analysis showed that people tended to be less happy when their minds were wandering than when they were not. This was the one conclusion, the one conclusion out of the whole study. And this was true no matter what they were doing, even if it was something that they considered the least enjoyable, the researchers reported. In conclusion, they said, a human mind is a wandering mind, and a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. Hey, isn't that an endorsement for this whole Zen meditation deal that we've been doing? Isn't it? Although it phrased it in a negative way. I don't know why it phrased it in a negative way. The equal conclusion from this is that a mind that is not wandering is a happy mind. Happy. Innately we're happy. When our mind just stills, and we come back to this, even if it's something we don't like, even if it's an activity we don't especially enjoy, if we engage in it, that's called sukha in Buddhism. That's called sukha. Simple happiness of being available to this very activity, whatever it is. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. When you try to stop activity to achieve passivity, your very effort fills you with activity. Uh-huh. So, we read this article and we think, oh, got it. Going to meditate. Going to come here on Sunday and sit for 40 minutes and start every day for 30 minutes and increase, really concentrate and really focus, so your mind gets all active. You get all anticipatory. You get all revved up about how you're going to be calm, how you're going to get enlightened. And what happens? Well, when you try to stop activity through to achieve passivity, your very effort fills you with activity. That's why when we do our meditation, we try not to evaluate. We try not to criticize. We do it over and over again like stupid people, not like smart people. My teacher said to me, he said, clever people will never understand our way. Stupider and stupider. So you do it, you do it, you do it. And so you can discover the joy of just engagement in life. Just engagement in this. When you try to stop activity to achieve passivity, your effort fills you with activity. As long as you remain in one extreme or the other, you will never know oneness. We know that, don't we? So this isn't some abstract oneness. This is just the oneness that's right here. We don't know it when we cut off from the world, when we cut off from our difficulties. We don't know it when we get entangled in them, when we start getting lost in someone else's pain or our pain. So here's another fairy tale. This is a Western fairy tale. This is about a Knight of the Round Table. The Knight of the Round Table gets lost in the woods and ends up drinking from a sacred well owned by an old hag, the archetypal figure of the wise woman in many cultures. The hag demands that the knight marry her. He begs for another option. So she says, "You don't have to marry me if you answer this question. What do women want?" Doesn't sound like the Knights of the Round Table to me. The knight spends a year interviewing women of the kingdom to get his answer. Then he meets the hag. Women want children, poverty, property, no, excuse me, property. Property, gold, to be loved, and so on and so forth. But the hag says, "Nope, that's not it. Now you have to marry me. Being an honorable guy, see, he'd just taken the precepts, right? When we first take the precepts, we're honorable for the next 10 minutes at least. Being an honorable guy, the king honors his duty. He marries the hag, much to the amusement and dismay of the people. That night she says, "Come kiss me." When he does, she turns into a beautiful princess. The knight is overjoyed, but then the woman says, "I can only stay like this half the time. So you choose. Would you rather have me be a hag while out and about during the day and beautiful at night with you in bed? Or would you rather have me be beautiful out during the day and a hag at night?" The knight contemplates the question for some time. Then he replies, "It's your choice. You decide." At that moment, the enchantment is lifted completely. "Now that you know what I want," she said, "I can be free of this curse and no longer a hag at all. I want to make my own choices." The knight is naturally thrilled. So is the princess. Most people, most of their lives are enchanted. We're enchanted. We're enchanted by, in an enmeshed kind of way, in an entangled kind of way, by our mother, or our partner, or our boss, or our own inadequacies, or we have a reverse kind of enchantment where we just withdraw and we're enchanted by our hopelessness. We're enchanted by our, "I'll just hang out with my cat." Or "I'll hang out with all my cats and this person, but not him." And we're enchanted. We're enchanted. And our life goes by. But we can choose to be engaged. We can choose to be here. We can choose to be available on every moment. On every moment. And when we really make that choice, the enchantment's broken. It's broken. It doesn't matter what the activity is. It really doesn't. So years ago, when I was trying to learn to be a therapist with this couple, I watched the therapist say, "Start working with him." And she said, "Oh, you know, he's so erratic. It's just better for me to be quiet and serve him an omelet." There were two of us. We were both guys. I don't know why, but he said to the guy, "Well, are you, you know, what is your erraticism about?" And the guy worked on his erraticism. She worked on her disengagement, and I don't know if they lived happily ever after. But at least they left that session making a commitment to engage. And if we can make a commitment to engage with one person, we can extend that. We can extend that. And sometimes the people closest to us is hardest to engage with, because we know their routines. We know how they piss us off. We know what we can do. And so often it's better to start far away and then move toward home. Move toward home. Although, if you can start at home, cool. As long as you remain in one or the other, you will not know oneness. You won't know oneness. And oneness is not abstract. It's right here. So I haven't told this story in a few years, but it's one of my favorite stories because I'm very attached to my daughter. And when my daughter was, when we lived in northern Minnesota, and my daughter was two, almost three, she had her third birthday in late August. In the summer, we went to Gooseberry Falls because we lived up there. We were hippie dippies up there, Zen hippie dippies. No drugs, just Zen. So we go to Gooseberry Falls and go swimming at the high, not down by the highway. There's a high falls. There's a great pool. If it's still there, who knows? And my son, who was 5, and me and my daughter, and my daughter, who was not quite 3 yet, would just jump in the water. She would just jump in the water. And, of course, I was delighted. And she'd go down, and she'd come up. And she'd go down, and she'd come up, and she'd paddle. And we had a wonderful time. And my son stayed on the edge. He stayed on the edge. Because my son had already developed his fear body. And my daughter had not developed her fear body yet. So she could just be in that water. Just in it. Up and down, in and out. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. It's one of my fondest memories. I mentioned it to her once, and she kind of looked at me, because she doesn't really like to swim very well. But I remember it. On the next year, you know what Minnesota's like. How long does our winter last? So then September 1, there's no swimming again until, almost July. She'd lost it. She'd lost her ability just to be one with that activity. And you know, if you actually go in the water and don't struggle, what happens? You do come back up. You do come up. You do float. But because of the fear body, we don't think the water is safe. We don't think it's safe. We want to find a nice little gentle eddy over there where it's calm, not realizing that the calmness is in the water itself, in the nature of the water and our being in the water. In falling and rising again, we are always kept in the same precious love. In the same precious love. We're kept in it. We don't have to do anything. We're kept in it. Continuing. As long as you remain in one or the other, you will not know oneness. So I've told lots of stories about my root teacher, Suzuki Roshi, about this. I'm not sure what story I'll tell this morning, but lots of you have heard them. Well, let's see, what story is coming up? Okay, there's a story about movies. How many of you heard me tell a story about him in movies before? Raise your hand. Oh, and maybe I shouldn't tell that story. There's a story about marijuana. How many of you heard me tell a story about him and marijuana before? Oh, 4 of you. Okay. Let's see, what other story? The story about hamburgers. How many of you heard me tell a story about him? Oh, no. I don't have any new stories. Same old. Which one should I tell?
Marijuana.
Marijuana? Okay. Marijuana. So this was in, remember, we're in San Francisco in, what's the year? What is that year? 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, around in then, San Francisco. So who's coming to the Zen Center to practice? Mostly potheads, right? Potheads and me. Oh, a few of us, but mostly potheads. this is a dilemma for these guys, for Suzuki Roshi and for Katagiri, who's just a very young man at the time. What to do? Well, obviously no drugs in the building, but sometimes you would go into the building and you would smell it just from it being in people's clothes. So we were in the car one time. Suzuki Roshi didn't drive, and the car reeked of marijuana, just reeked of marijuana. And I heard the guy sitting next to Suzuki Roshi talking to him, and I thought the guy seemed kind of high to me. And I heard Suzuki say, "Oh, I'm not for or against marijuana. I'm just trying to show people our way. Our way." So that's engagement, isn't it? Isn't that engagement? So the potheads kept coming, but by the time we started Tassajara, most of the potheads had given up their pot. Now, not all of them. Not all of them, but most of them have. And you know, if you engage with someone, if you really engage with someone, you'd be surprised at what happens in terms of the relationship, in terms of what their what your availability makes them feel available. It makes them feel available. So that's why I call Suzuki Roshi the my Naga master, the Naga, the serpent king, the Nagarjuna. Different from the serpent in the Old Testament or the New Testament, that's for sure. So Suzuki Roshi's had a couple of favorite Zen teachers, he told me, Chinese Zen teachers. One of them was Joshu, or Chaocho. Another was Umon, or Yunmen. Unmen. Unmen means cloud gate. So Unmen was the cloud gate master. Cloud gate. He entered the gate, which was and shrouded in clouds. He entered that gate. He didn't wait for the clear sky. He didn't pine away for the clear sky. He entered that gate, and that's where he discovered freedom, in the entering that gate, the cloud gate. That's where he discovered composure. So this story by him, which is one of my favorites, and I have not talked about for maybe 2.5 years or something. Yunmen said to his monks, I do not want to ask you about the last 30 days. He doesn't want to ask you. I don't want to ask you guys about the last 30 days. If we do that, you'll be in therapy with me forever. I'm not a therapist anymore anyway, so forget it. I don't want to ask you about it. Well, you know how many sessions it's going to take us to sort out the last 30 days if you really get into them? You should do that with your therapist. But in Zen, I don't want to ask you about that stuff. I don't want to ask you about that stuff because you get entangled in it. You get entangled in it. Well, I'm a good therapist. I don't get entangled in it, but you do. And, of course, I'm doing my best to unentangle. But I'm a Zen teacher here, not a therapist, so I don't ask you about it. Don't ask you about it. I only want to ask you about the next 30 days. Are you going to make a commitment to engage in your moments, to be present in your moments? If they're easy or hard, if they're with someone you like or dislike, are you going to make that commitment? That's Zen practice. That's Zen practice. And it has to involve Zen sitting, because without learning about how the mind entangles itself, you can't engage. You can't engage. I don't want to ask you about the last 30 days. I just want to ask you about the next 30 days. And of course, what happens? None of the monks respond. None of the monks respond. And so then, what does Unmen say? He says, every day is a good day. Every day is a good day. And of course, this may seem kind of facile to you, kind of like a cliche to you, but it's not. It's not. Thich Nhat Hanh's expression, only moment on the in-breath, precious moment on the out-breath. Pretty good, huh? Pretty good. And whenever we do that, we let go of the body of fear that drives us, that keeps us from really being available and experiencing the love that's just in things as they are. So that's what I want to say for this morning. Questions, comments? Good.
You talked about wanting enlightenment.
Yep.
Hindrance that could be. What if one cultivates the thought of wanting enlightenment for the sake of others, for the sake of all beings? Is that a helpful thing, or is it still a hindrance because it's still the self wanting something?
Well, I actually don't think that wanting enlightenment is necessarily a hindrance. If I hadn't wanted enlightenment, I would have given up in 1960 something or other. I don't think it's a hindrance. It's just getting entangled in it and starting to judge and criticize and compare. Geez, look at Ted. He's sitting perfectly. He just only been sitting for 2 months, and look at me. I'll never get this, and I want it. Maybe I should do extra yoga. And so Buddha wanted enlightenment. He saw sickness, he saw old age, he saw death, and he was bummed out. But it was when he saw the beatific person, the person who was in the moment, who was engaged in just this, but that's what inspired him. He wanted it. But it was only when he settled down and quit pissing and moaning and comparing and contrasting and criticizing that his practice became mature. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So, there's a difference between wanting and maybe grasping at it, becoming entangled.
Yeah. Yes, there's the Tibetan expression, drive all desires into one. The one desire, which is to engage in this moment, if you drive all your desires into that one desire, enlightenment is not very far off. Not very far off at all.
So if I want enlightenment by paying attention at this moment, that's a little different than wanting enlightenment sometime off in the future.
That goes on forever. That goes on lifetime after lifetime. You just have to. No. It's a little different. But you can do that too. You can do anything. The middle way includes. So the middle way includes entanglement and disengagement, and don't worry about it. This is just a talk. Don't try to get it figured out. Just give yourself to something that you don't understand and that's always here. And if you get entangled, so what? It's a human situation. Any others, you guys? Anything else, you guys?